This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Christopher Chalenza, professor of history and classics, as well as the James B. Knapp Dean of the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins. And today we're going to talk about Professor Chalenza's 2017 book, Petrarch, Everywhere a Wanderer, which is being released in paper this year by Reaction Books. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Jan. I'm so glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing okay. You know, we're climbing out of the pandemic here. It's a little bit quieter during the month of July. Dean's offices tend to be busy all year round, but we have a little respite right now.
That's great. Yeah, you know, I was just reviewing your CV, and you haven't slowed down. Like, somehow becoming a dean has not slowed your production of scholarship down. Is that witchcraft? What?
I think I describe myself as a tortoise. So I try to do a little something every day in the early morning, and then the administrative day begins. But if you do it every day, it tends to add up. So I'm really a tortoise. It's always just whatever little project I'm working on, I do a little, even if it's just a half hour.
Right on, slow and steady. Well, all right. So let's talk about this CV, because our first job here is to kind of put this in the context of your broader intellectual path. And it seems to fit quite neatly, like right in your wheelhouse. We've got Renaissance humanism and the papal curia, 1999. Was that your dissertation? Yeah. And then Piety and Pythagoras in Renaissance Florence, Brill 2001. I love that press. The Last Italian Renaissance in 2006, Machiavelli 2015. You got this guy in 2017, and then two more since then, The Intellectual World of the Italian Renaissance, and then The Italian Renaissance and the Origins of Modern Humanities. So, I mean, I think it's fair to characterize you as a very solid, you are a Renaissance historian's Renaissance historian, right? Deeply enmeshed in the intellectual world of Renaissance Italy. So what made you turn to Petrarch?
You know, it's very interesting. It was actually very fortuitous. I was directing the American Academy in Rome from 2010 to 14. And while I was there, I was contacted by Reaction Press to see if I wanted, they were starting a new series of books on Renaissance lives. And they contacted me at the time to see if I was interested in doing a book on Machiavelli, but I was already writing one on Machiavelli for which wound up coming out with Harvard University Press. And I'd been thinking a lot about Petrarch. And so I just asked, well, what about Petrarch? And I wrote a little proposal and they accepted it. And then when I left and I came back, you know, I had that on the radar. And I taught a few classes on Petrarch when I came back to Johns Hopkins after in 2014. And very memorably, one semester I taught both an undergraduate and a graduate class. And a lot of the texts that I deal with in the book were texts that we worked on in those classes. In fact, one chapter in the book is on the correspondence between Petrarch, right, who lived from 1304 to 1374, and his friend and slightly younger contemporary, Boccaccio, the author of the Decameron. And I remember teaching those three letters that I focus on in that chapter. Those were the graduate class, basically, the Latin letters, and we read them together. So that's how it all came together, and it was a lot of fun to write. It was the first time I'd ever really worked with a lot of illustrations. The press reaction started out as an art press, basically, and so they were very interested in having illustrations. And so that was something very new to me and made me really sympathize with what art historians have to, you know, deal with when they publish, because there's all these permissions you have to get and things like that. So anyway, it was a lot of fun to do the book.
You know, Reaction's a great press for it's very solid scholarly work, but it's also approachable. And this book is the same, right? It's very readable, and it seems like it would speak to a broader audience. Was that your goal here as well?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I've sort of become convinced, this is even happening in my own administrative strategy a little bit, that the work we do in universities is very, very important because it's about the advancement of new knowledge. And what tends to happen there is you're inevitably going to be speaking to specialist communities, because advancement of new knowledge is often a game of inches. But I think we should build into our work the consciousness that there is a very curious public out there. Curious not for, you know, condescension or nostrums, but curious for new things, new ideas, new interpretations. But developing that register to speak to the broader public is something that I think we all in academia should be doing, because I think it helps us make the case as to why we have legitimacy, why our institutions have legitimacy.
And it's something I think that is almost trained out of us, right? I mean, the part of grad school, we all joke about it, but, you know, it's kind of true. The part of grad school is learning not to speak to anyone.
You know? Yeah, I know. It's interesting. I take great inspirations from colleagues too. We have this wonderful colleague here at Johns Hopkins named Martha Jones, and she recently published a brilliant award-winning book called Vanguard. And the book is about the hitherto little known place that Black women in the United States had in the search for universal suffrage. And through this really kind of painstaking archival work, Martha found all of these new ways that Black women contributed through civic organizations and churches and so on. But she wrote it in such a way that it really is, as you said before, it's approachable. And I think it's the kind of work that will eventually change how U.S. history is taught once it's received, which it will be over time. And so you take inspiration from people like that who are doing work that really is, you know, by any scholarly definition, tied to sources, solid, not just repeating old narratives. But you think about, you know, talking to people who, I always think about smart undergraduate students, right? They might not know much about a topic at hand, but they're going to ask the most pressing questions, the why is it important question. And so that's the audience I also try to keep in mind as well, is, you know, what would it take to introduce somebody who I know is smart and firing on all pistons, but just might not be a specialist in this or that field.
Right. And like what might be of interest to them, what's going to speak to broader narratives. You know, so speaking of source material, though, before we get any further into like the meat of this book, what did you look at for Petrarch?
Well, you know, the other thing that, to be frank, was very appealing about this is that there's still a lot of there's still some manuscript work to be done on Petrarch, but the truth is that his major works have been edited and some re-edited and edited and translated and so on. So it was the kind of work that by the time I started writing it, I really was doing a lot of administrative work, which meant that I was traveling a lot and so on. It was the kind of thing you could do on the move. One thing I have not been able to do too much of anymore is, you know, spending those 8-hour days in libraries and archives and things like that I did at the earlier part of my career. But so, I mean, the work was all of his, you know, edited works, you know, his many vernacular works. And then I think what I really tried to highlight in the book was that in his own life, his Latin work was very important to him. And within a few generations, it kind of stopped being important. And I wanted to plumb that as well. You know, I say at the outset of the book that there's sort of, you know, three different sort of versions of Petrarch, right? There's, you know, the inaugurator of the Renaissance, right, who back to antiquity and then seeks a better way to modernity. There's Petrarch, the vernacular poet, right, the Tuscan poet who writes love poetry. And that's really why if he's known today, that's why he's known. But then there was Petrarch, the Latin writer. And, you know, that, again, is something in which there is a profusion of works of his, but just very, very little studied. And I will say that, you know, one relies on the absolutely crucial work of many, many scholars, often in Italy, who have done painstaking work, not just of editing his text, but even things like his annotations. And it's incredibly important, like when you see how somebody is reading a work by the what they put in the margins of the work, you can actually kind of gauge them reading in something like real time, you know. And so even that kind of painstaking work, given how important he is in the Italian literary tradition, he's even those sorts of things have been edited. So there is a rich variety of source material from which to draw. And, you know, you stand on the shoulders of people who've done that work.
Absolutely. That work, I think, is something that's really neat, the annotation where you can see this dialectic between this famous, like, you know, this author and kind of how he's writing and how he's reading. And you can really get into his head. Quick question. Why do you think his, like, Petrarch, the Latin writer, is it kind of falls out of fashion or just is kind of forgotten for a while?
You know, it goes back to the Renaissance itself. So he's seen in some ways. I mean, you know, if you look at the work of, for example, my mentor Ron Witt showed in a brilliant book that Petrarch, in some ways, you could argue is a third generation humanist. And to make that argument, you have to make the case that Renaissance humanism was mostly about writing classical Latin. So there's two intellectual generations before him coming out of the north of Italy, Padua. Where people are writing in Latin and they're interested in the classical world. So Petrarch comes along third generation and brings this Christian sensibility to his work. So that's Ron Witt's argument. And I think it's largely valid. But there's also a way in which there's something unique about Petrarch. So even if it might not be right to call him, let's say, the first Italian humanist, he's the first one who makes it a broad movement, right, so to speak. But intellectual life proceeds in generations. And so the next generation, you could argue, is headed up by someone whom Petrarch knew, Coluccio Salutati. And then right after that, the people that Salutati trained in Florence. There's a thinker named Leonardo Bruni, for example. And Bruni and others of that generation credit Petrarch with that one of those three things that I mentioned before. They credit him as being the one who opened the door to antiquity, who said, well, it's really important for us if we're going to help the modern world to look to antiquity. But even by that point, they start to look down is too strong a term, but they start to look at his Latin as less than perfectly classical, because by their generation, they had done so much work on writing Latin in the style of Cicero, you know, the exemplar of classical Latin, that they came to see his attempts as not quite fumbling, but not quite up to their era. And so even from that very beginning, it's not that his works weren't known, but they ceased to be things that are in the vanguard of scholarship, even in the early 15th century. And then later, you know, there's a second, much larger reason, which is that a lot of our humanities disciplines, I think, came together in their modern form in the 19th century. And in the early 19th century, as modern universities were rising up, you know, in Berlin in 1810 and other exemplars, a few cultural assumptions were in the air. One of these assumptions was that was about authenticity in native languages. So the idea was that, you know, these Italian thinkers in Petrarch's wake, Petrarch himself and these Italian thinkers in his wake, they almost took a wrong turn in writing in Latin, as many of them did, which is to say, again, this idea of turning toward the ancient past was great because, you know, that becomes this exemplar for so many people. But what they should have done was focus on their vernacular writings. When you pair that with the rise of what you could argue is nationalistic history writing in the 19th century, you have not only Petrarch's Latin writings falling off the radar, but as I tried to show in my long ago book now, The Lost Italian Renaissance, you have a lot of Renaissance Latin writings falling off the scholarly radar, only to be rediscovered in the early 20th century by heroes of the field like Paul Oscar Christeller and Eugenio Guarin. So it's complicated, right? I mean, for Petrarch himself, it's his own era. And then, you know, for the larger problem of what do you do about this profusion of Latin work that's written in this long, you know, say period from say 1300 to 1600, what do you do about all that? There's reasons, I think, why it's taken a backseat.
That's fascinating that the idea, you know, that part of creating this kind of myth of Petrarch as the father of the Renaissance involves doing away with a lot of the work that meant a lot to him.
Yes, indeed. It's very interesting, right? It's very, very interesting. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about this. How is he the father of the Renaissance? Like, this idea, as if anyone gets that title.
I think in some ways that is it's an argument that can be made. And again, I think if you dig into the specialized scholarship, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there's work by Ronald Witt and others that show that, you know, there's this broad continuity, right? Throughout, let's say, the High Middle Ages, let's say the period from, you know, roughly 1050 to 1300, where, you know, if you start to plunk yourself down in the 12th century in France, you see a lot of interest in classical works in the ancient world. You see some of that happening in emerging centers of new knowledge, like, you know, cathedral schools, then eventually in the 13th century in universities. You see some of it being translated into works of troubadour poets. And you see some of that work coming south from France into northern Italy. And then all of a sudden you see that classicizing energy, you know, begin to take place in Latin. So in that sense, right, if you could argue that there's this broad interest in the Middle Ages in the classical world, but I think with Petrarch, a number of things come together in an almost obsessive way. So first, there's interest in the ancient world, which, again, people are, you know, doing this work in Italy. The great scholar Carrie Benesch, for example, wrote this wonderful book about how medieval Italy, you know, thought, looked at the ancient world. So that's there for Petrarch, the ancient world. There's this really profound sense that the Latin language then in use in his day didn't match the grandeur of ancient Latin. And so what does this mean to unpack it, right? You know, Latin as a native language dies out in Europe. It's hard to know exactly when, but let's say, you know, roughly the 8th century, right? But it becomes, you know, it's hard to know, like, when is somebody writing something, saying something in the vernacular, but writing it down in Latin. But, you know, the first sort of instances of the vernaculars that we have are usually from the 10th century, right? We start to see things written down. But Latin is still in use as the language of education and culture, and the language often of diplomacy, and importantly, the language of the church. So Petrarch starts to feel that, okay, so I have this appreciation for classical antiquity, on the other hand, that a lot of other people have. I have this very profound sensitivity to the Latin language. I see that the Latin in use in universities around me isn't quite matching up with, you know, the Latin of antiquity that I'm coming to love. And I think there's a third thing for Petrarch that really does, if you were going to say he's the father of the Renaissance, I would say this is why. And that is that we see the beginnings of something that runs through a lot of the work of a lot of Italian humanists, not all of them, but a lot of them. And that is a sense that contemporary institutions aren't doing the job they should be doing. So Petrarch really becomes, you know, the first major thinker to criticize universities in his day. And for him, again, this criticism is coming from what he believes to be a Christian perspective, right? He's saying, look, you're studying theology in universities like Paris and other places, but you're doing it in this way that's very logically oriented. It's about syllogisms. When you go back to read the New Testament, it's more about, you know, humble evangelization and the messages of the Sermon on the Mount. You're missing all of that universities, right? So I think if he's the father of the Renaissance, I argue that one of the most distinctive things about Renaissance humanism throughout the 15th century is actually this, the ability to create a posture of being anti-institutional and using that posture to criticize institutions. I say posture because most Renaissance humanists, Petrarch very much included, spent time at universities, but they still are able to sort of extract themselves from them and look in and criticize them. And maybe I could add just one more thing, Jan. I don't want to go on too long with this. You know, there's something about institutions, and now that I'm a university administrator, I see this. Here's some facts, right? In the year 1300, we can track about 15, 16 universities that had arisen by that point in Europe. If you look at the work of Jacques Vergès and others who studied this. If you fast forward to the year 1500, you can track well over 60 of them. So what that meant is, in a lot of ways, they were doing the work they were supposed to do. They were useful, right? There were a lot of students that were going to universities. Most of the students weren't there to become professional scholars, right? Most of them were there to get some training, to get a Bachelor of Arts degree, maybe a Master of Arts degree, then go work in bureaucracies in Europe and things like that. But what's inevitable, right, is that is something that Marcia Kolisch and others have studied, which is that as those universities grew, oftentimes curricula became standardized. And you could legitimately make the critique, as some people from inside universities actually did, that we're starting to ask questions, not because they matter to the world that's currently around us now, but because they're on the curriculum. Or you could make the critique that a number of people from within the university world did too, that we're getting too hyper-specialized, that we're talking only to each other. And so I think it's kind of an eternal problem with the organization of knowledge is that, you know, you get together, you become very good at passing on traditions, which is something we have to do, right? I mean, you still have to teach calculus, right? Even if you're teaching in a new way, it's still calculus, you know, the modern world, obviously. But sometimes universities and institutions of higher learning have trouble being nimble and reacting to the outside world. So to turn back to Petrarch, you know, there's numerous cases in his work where he criticizes universities, and that's a style of criticism that really has legs. You can look at everybody in the Renaissance, you know, Poggio Bracciolini, Leonardo Bruni, Lorenzo Valla, even somebody who was a university professor later, like Angelo Poliziano, who died in 1494. He was a professor at the University of Florence, but he still criticized parts of the university. So that's something that has legs. So to get back to your question, is he the father of the Renaissance? I think that is a way to think about it, right? I would say he's clearly like, you know, the key exponent of this anti-institutional side.
So we've got this guy writing in Latin, classical, like really classical knowledge here, like working in Latin. We have a new school of critique and a new way, at least, you know, kind of introducing a new way of thinking about the world. And then we've got this beautiful love poet. It makes sense of this from, tell me a little bit about his poetry and him as a poet.
No, exactly. Yeah. It's very interesting. You know, I think there's a public posture that he creates. And the public posture is, when I was young, I cared about love and I cared about things that aren't so serious. As I got older, you know, I started to care about serious things like history and religion. And in that transformation, I moved away from writing vernacular love poetry and I moved into writing, quote, serious, unquote, stuff in Latin. That's the public posture. And if you read his correspondence with Boccaccio, he tries to sort of talk about it in that way. But on the other hand, we know that he, throughout his entire life, revised his canzoniere, right? This is his great set of, you know, poems in the Tuscan vernacular. He revised it 9 times and never stopped. Right, so the actual practice of his life, we know it mattered to him greatly. Why does he create this public posture? Well, a couple of the things he reveals, I would say almost inadvertently in letters to Boccaccio, he's got this mountain under whose shadow he's operating. And that mountain is Dante Alighieri, right, who had earlier in the century written his comedy, later called the Divine Comedy because it was so beloved. That was almost a summation of a lot of thinking of the medieval world. It was a truly stunningly beautiful use of the Tuscan language. So Petrarch feels like he's writing a little bit in Dante's shadow, number one. And then number two, the story he also tells is, and this is where I do think there's something to talk about here. He really does want to be remembered centuries hence. It's unusual in that way, right? You don't find this in the Middle Ages that much. You know, it's unusual that he wants to be remembered like this. So he comes to believe that Latin has a little bit more of a permanence about it, right? It lasted from antiquity to now. So as far as the Italian poet goes, as you talk about, he does a few things. Well, one, you know, he has this sighting in 1327, he says, in Avignon of a woman named Laura. Right. And so this becomes his muse. And in some ways, right, this is, you know, one of these fascinating things to behold. In another way, I think it's part of the, I would say, deeply baked in, you know, misogyny, right, in the Western world. Like Laura really isn't a person with feelings and a personality and thoughts of her own. She becomes, you know, like a thing for him, a thing on which you base your poetry and so on. So everything in some ways he argues is dedicated to her when he writes. And, you know, he sees her as a symbol of purity, of beauty, of chastity, of all the things that he's having trouble with in life. He sees her as in some ways the solution, right? So the poetry is sometimes about that. The poetry is also often about Italy itself. You know, because he was born in Florence, but his father was exiled from the city of Florence in the same series of political purges in which Dante himself had been exiled. Petrarch, oddly enough, for a Tuscan poet, grows up in France. Why? The papal court, you know, from the first decade of the 14th century through to the 1370s and then beyond to an extent, is located in Avignon, France, right? It's this long period in which the papacy is not in Rome and it's in France. So Petrarch grows up there. His father, who had been a notary, which is kind of like what we think of when we think of a lawyer today, you know, somebody who would help you with documents and, you know, contracts and things like that. Papacy needs a lot of those because it's a big institution by that point. His father goes there as a notary. Petrarch grows up there in France. And so I think this image of himself as a Florentine, this notion in his poetry of cultivating himself as a specifically Tuscan Florentine writer, right, writing the vernacular, writing Italian, but Tuscan Italian, it's ever more emphasized by the fact that he sees himself as a kind of exile. And so those, you know, we talked about the poetry that's about love. There's also poetry that's about Italy, one that's called Italia Mia. And again, this is, you know, something shaped by the sense of exile. Shaped by this sense of, you know, I didn't get to see Rome until I was older. He finally goes to Rome and sees these ruins. He's inspired by, you know, as anybody would be in the Middle Ages, these gigantic things that are crumbling, but that in their own ruinous beauty evince the idea that there had been an ancient empire, that there had been something great in the past, in the distant past. And so there's this truly, I think, impractical, you know, idealistic, never to be realized dream, right, that Italy would come together again. And so some of the poetry points to that, right, points to the fact that, you know, oh, our rulers are dissolute, we should come together, we should kick all these foreigners out, foreigners meaning like Germans who are coming in, right, else is coming in, right, and we should unify Italy again. I mean, Italia Mia becomes so important that Machiavelli himself uses lines from it as the very closing lines of The Prince, you know, hundreds of years later. So those themes are there, right? There's themes of Italy shaped by his notion of exile. There's themes of love, you know, and idealism. And again, I think it also tells us something interesting, just maybe to close with this on the poetry. As I mentioned, we know of 9 different, what we call authorial redactions during his life, meaning he sort of, you know, reordered the poems at different times, you know, added things, subtracted things. It tells us something about publication in that era too, right? This is before printing with movable type. And I say in the book, only somewhat facetiously, that you only really have a final editorial version when you're dead, right? Because, you know, he would have probably, had he lived longer, he would have kept revising them. So I think that's interesting too, this idea that he's very conscious as well. One of his letters to Boccaccio, just to close with the Italian poetry, one of the reasons he pretends to have stopped dealing with it is he says, people are going around reciting it, but they're making mistakes. You know, they're saying things I didn't say, right? And so publication is this very interesting thing. How did you make stuff public back then in an era before we have, you know, like we have now, you know, hundreds of thousands of printed books and so on? So,
You paint this picture of a very interesting person, which is another thing that I've really enjoyed about this. Petrarch is one of these like incredibly famous historical figures, but I mean, in some ways, maybe more of a myth or an idea than an actual person. And you know, he's invoked in so many ways, but this book really deals with him in this other way. I feel like I understand Petrarch as a human being going about the world.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I remember when I was teaching those classes I was telling you about, both classes were memorable, but the undergraduate class was very memorable because the students would alternate in their perception of him between things like, oh my God, I can't believe he's so self-centered. And then the next minute saying, oh, you know, because he would have this thing where he's very, you know, conflicted. And what I mean by that is, you know, he's almost obsessively focused on himself, right? So he writes letters about himself, you know, he's always worried about his reputation on the one hand, but on the other hand, we have these works of his. One of the works I focus on in the book at length is a work called The Secret. And this is a dialogue that he wrote in Latin between idealized versions of himself and the church father Augustine, right, who lived from 354 to 430, was the author of the Confessions and the City of God, and really arguably the most famous sort of early Christian, you know, relatively early Christian church father. And in that work, Petrarch is tormented. And again, both personae, he's writing the whole thing, right? So, but you know, his own persona, Franciscus, in the dialogue, says, I can't stop, I can't free myself from the two chains that bind me. And Augustus says, what are the two chains? Well, the two chains are love and glory, right? And love meaning like this obsession with Lauda, and for him, though, that there's also a lot there. Like, he was very conscious of his own sex life in his early years. You know, he was alternately, like Augustine had been, you know, guilty about it, but unable to free himself of it. And then glory, right? Wanting to win glory because of his poetry. And so in that sense, you're right. I mean, it's a very human, you know, there's a very human story, I think, there, which is somebody who, you know, clearly suffered with depression. In that dialogue, he and Augustine talk about his, what they use the term for is aegritudo in Latin. And that, you know, means like, it can mean listlessness, but the way it's talked about, you can tell that there's a depression there. So he has these moments where he's very public. He arranges, for example, in the city of Rome, through a carefully constructed set of letters, that he would receive a laurel wreath on the Capitoline Hill. So he does that. So at times he's very public, he's advising people, he's doing some diplomacy. Then there are times when he just has to retreat from everybody. So he had bought this little place called Vaucluse, and retreats there and is all alone. And so he's very torn between, I think, again, you know, the need for glory and reputation on the one hand, and then the need to just kind of be with himself and to be thinking and meditating on the other. In that sense, too, there's something very unique. And I would hesitate to go all modern versus medieval here, but, you know, there is a famous writer, Jean Leclerc, who wrote this wonderful book about medieval thinking and spirituality. And one of the things that Leclerc noted about a number of medieval thinkers, and he's talking about sort of, you know, early Middle Ages to the beginnings of the High Middle Ages, right? So, is that you would focus a lot on book learning, right? But you would do that so that you could eventually forget the book learning and get closer to God. And I think with Petrarch, that side is there. He really does want that. But on the other hand, he can't ever really do it because he really wants that glory too. He really wants his poetry and he wants his Latin writing and he wants to be seen as an authority figure. So in that sense, you're right. I mean, there's a very human story there, I think, that again, in an unusual way, he reveals to us.
Augustine is the person he should be talking to then, right? Those two, they're very copacetic personages.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What did you want your reader to take away when they're done with this? What do you want them to know?
You know, I think to understand, in obviously a very short book, but to understand that this was a full life lived, you know, that there really were different aspects to this figure Petrarch about whom, you know, you hear not nearly as often as Dante, right? But, you know, one hears of him in the history of culture, in the history of writing, in the history of poetry, history of literature. But to know that there was this really deep, interesting person, to know that, you know, like a lot of folks from the pre-modern period, parts of his work survived and parts didn't. The parts that do survive don't necessarily reflect what was important to him at the time, right? Or rather, they don't give a fullness of it. And then also just to sort of immerse oneself in a world where, you know, there's no internet, right? There's no printing with movable type. There's no mass transit, right? There's not really truly kind of ideas of universal human rights the way we kind of maybe implicitly think of them now. And so it's a very different world, right? And so to give people also a taste of just what was it like to live then? What was it like to live when, you know, in one of his sets of letters, you know, he talks about having to travel with an armed escort. And that wasn't unusual, right? You
know? Right, yeah.
So, you know, so I mean, it's sort of that kind of thing as well.
Sure. Yeah, you get this image of a very, very different world. And I think that, I mean, there's a lot, if you want to understand the intellectual world of the Renaissance, you could do worse than to learn from Petrarch. Yeah. You could do worse than to read this book for sure. Oh,
yeah. No, I think that I hope so. Yeah. I hope a lot of the things are there because I think one of the things I find very interesting about the world we're living in now and I don't know if you agree with this, is that I think we're going through this real transformation in media and in how we're kind of reading the world, right? You know, and I think that when you start to focus on that sort of thing, in other words, what are the instruments by which you're dealing with the world? You know, for us often, right, we're bombarded by, you know, texts of all sorts that are coming at us on computer screens, through earbuds, on phones, on tablets, and so on, which is to say that the material culture of intellectual life is important, right? I mean, we wouldn't be experiencing the world in the way we're experiencing it if it weren't right now mediated through those sorts of features, or many of us wouldn't. Just so, I think that to me, it's always important that when we're thinking about, you know, these Renaissance figures, quote, Renaissance, unquote, figures, to realize what a starkly different world it was in terms of information, how you got information, right? In another one of my books, I have this little story about somebody named Angelo de Chembre, who's very little known. And one of the things we have of his is we have a supplication that he wrote to a political leader. This is a special request he wrote. And the request was this. He had been traveling around. He had been working as a bibliographer in Spain, this de Chembre was. And he was robbed by bandits. And he lists what he was robbed of. And among the most poignant things are unbound quires of books that he was writing himself, right? And that's it. That's like, you lost your whole hard drive, you lost your cloud stuff, you lost everything. And what he was wanting was, he wanted this ruler to pay the ransom, right? But, you know, you, every once in a while in the Renaissance, you get these windows into that. And, you know, with Petrarch too, given that he has been so obsessively studied, we do have a sense that, you know, he worked very hard on the physical part of writing, right? That mattered to him. He cared about how his handwriting worked and how handwriting itself worked. We know that, given that his father was a notary, scholars like Armando Petrucci have reviewed some of Petrarch's re-editing of his own Italian poetry and have seen characteristic marks on the pages that notaries would use. So all of that, I think, is necessary, too, to think about, you know, what's the material culture through which we're experiencing the world? I think we often tend to just put it slightly off center stage. And to me, just because of the transformation we're living through now, it seemed much more center stage, too. So that's why throughout the book, there are, you know, these, I do talk about actually his annotations. And I talk about his manuscripts and how he wrote and so on.
Wonderful. Cool. All right. So I've taken up a ton of your time already, quite enough. So just one last question. What are you working on now? What's next?
A couple of little things. So I guess the thing that I'm interested in now is I'm trying to write a short history, or not even history, I would say a short historical account of the arts and sciences and why they matter now. And so it's a very short book that reaches back to the ancient liberal arts, the way those arts were studied and deployed in medieval universities, the challenges to university life of the Renaissance, the great transformation in the early 19th century, when I think something like our modern sense of the arts and sciences really come into being, and then how they can matter now in the world of universities. Because I've noticed that a lot of us who do administrative work in universities, and especially I would say people who are at a level above me, presidents and provosts, are sometimes under pressure from boards of trustees or the outside world, you know, to think about, well, why do you do these disciplines that sometimes seem disconnected from the world, or that have long time horizons and their discoveries and so on. And so I'm just trying to make the case as to why that's still valid, because I think it is. So that's what I've been working on.
Oh, thank you. Someone, please, 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 please. Yeah, let's hope. Yeah, this idea that we don't, that what we're doing isn't, you know, connected or isn't useful in the modern world, is we're asking just simply what it means to be a human being. And I don't know what is more valid and more important right now.
I think that's right. Now, especially, right? I mean, you know, just given where we are when it comes to, you know, all the literature that you're reading recently on post-humanity, right? And things like that. I do think it's important to reflect, I mean, to keep discovering things about the past, because I think there's always things that have touch points to the world that we're in now. So.
Wonderful. All right. Chris Chalenza, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to me this your morning. It was an absolute joy. Right, listeners, again, this is Petrarch. So when will we see this in paper?
Paperback, it's supposed to come out this August, actually.
Okay, yeah.
soon.
I think. So very soon. The hardcover is still available to you, but in August, PetShark everywhere.
I think they may have sold out of all. I think they're still out there. They're still available, but the paper version is orderable now. So
excellent. Yeah. From Reaction Books, PetShark Everywhere, a Wanderer. All right. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thanks, Anna.